Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What ideas about power, religion, healthcare, and media will carry us into the future? And how are those ideas strengthened by being scrutinized, discussed, and challenged? This Saturday, March 26th, the Dallas Institute will host its second Festival of Ideas, allowing those in the audience at the DMA to hear and interact with panels of experts from around the country. Lee Cullum is a journalist and political analyst who hosts CEO on KERA Channel 13 television. She will serve as moderator of the Festival of Ideas. George Getchow will participate in the discussion about the future of journalism and media. He teaches journalism at the University of North Texas, where he is writer in residence for the Mayborn Literary Nonfiction Conference. George, Lee, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Lee, let's start by talking about the purpose of something as wonderfully named as a Festival of Ideas. How are the top chosen, and are they meant to relate to one another?
Oh, Chris, I think they probably do relate to one another. We think of power, the sources of power, the uses of power, and that leads you very quickly to media and the power of the media and how it's going to serve power and to serve the powerless to gain the power that they need. Certainly, religion has been very important to power in the world, as we know, we hope creating harmony in the future, but certainly it's been known for discord. And medicine may seem tangential, but really it isn't. Without assuring our health, how are we going to avail ourselves of all the other three? So I think they do relate. And to say it's a festival of ideas is to say that we're going to have a good time. It's going to be thoughtful, but it's also going to be jubilant.
I called you moderator, but the website calls you ringmaster.
Oh, my word. Where is my whip? I haven't quite acclimated to the role of ringmaster, but I'll have to figure it out.
But it's a structured forum, but there is a lot of back and forth between the participants.
Yes. Oh, yeah. In fact, that's the idea. The idea, first of all, is that the keynoters, Ken Auletta and Mark Oppenheimer and Steve Krasner and a couple of wonderful doctors, Ruth Faden and Tom Beecham, of course, we'll make important presentations, but then we have people from this area, like George Getchow, who's here with me today, responding and advancing their own thoughts and ideas. And then, of course, as the day goes on, the audience then evolves into participants. And they, too, take part in the conversation. As you know, you and I were there together two years ago.
Great fun, actually.
Yes. Yeah. So the idea is for everybody to take part, everybody to have a say.
So for purposes of today's discussion, since we have just an hour, we wanted to talk about the future of journalism and media. Is it really as absolutely bleak as seemingly every analyst suggests these days?
George doesn't think so.
Well, no, I don't. I'm actually pretty positive about the future of journalism. There's a great deal of discussion and debate across the country about the old media and the new media. The old media, of course, representing newspapers and magazines and places that did traditional investigative reporting, places that provided news and information, but also stories. And then you have the new media, which represents the blogosphere, represents Huffington Post, and represents Google in many ways, which is changing, which I consider a media company that's changing the way in which news and information is delivered. So that's creating sort of cataclysmic changes in what we think of the media. We've heard about layoffs and downsizing in newspapers and magazines. We've heard about less and less investigations at newspapers. We've heard about less foreign bureaus and less coverage. But what we're now finding is that the insatiable appetite for good stories, for those stories that make us think, stories that make us feel, stories that make us more human, those stories, I think, the need and the appetite for those kinds of stories has never gone away. And so what we're finding is more and more newspapers and more magazines are turning to narrative as a way out of the wilderness.
And also, Chris, you know, readership is down, viewership is down. David Carr had a piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago saying that readership of newspapers is down 5%. Radio is down except NPR, which is up. I have to put in a plug for you and me, especially you. Magazines down 9%, more than any other. But one magazine that seems to be doing pretty well is called This Week. It made $4 million last year. That's not a lot of money by Google standards.
$4 million.
Anyway, if we made $4 million, we'd be very happy. May make $6 million this year. And what it is what Time Magazine began to be all those years ago with Haddon and Luce, which is a composite of news from all over the world on a weekly basis, done on paper that's not very fancy, graphics that are not very elegant, but that will inform people who are very busy but want to know what's going on and want to know pretty quickly. It's doing well. So there's a hunger for hard news.
One thing that always distresses me about the way we talk about media these days, and journalism in particular, is that it always ends up being a conversation about the business of journalism. And it feels like we have very few conversations about editorial practices and how decisions are being made about what gets covered. Is that something that we simply have to sacrifice for now while we figure out how to get all this paid for?
What do you think, George?
I think I can answer that question by what you're expressing, I think, is a view among many journalists and storytellers around the country that are concerned about sort of the ambition of newspapers and magazines. What are we willing, what can we do given our limited resources? What are our capabilities? And how can we continue to deliver content, stories that matter, stories that change the way we see the world? How can we continue to do that in a time when you have free content available online? And I think the answer is increasingly providing ways to deliver long-form journalism, narrative journalism, stories that matter in a variety of ways. The New Republic, for example, just announced that they're coming out with a brand new long-form journalism site. It's not going to replace what they're offering online. In fact, they're expanding their regular online, what they call short-form journalism content. But they've decided that there's this huge void in providing stories, not just information, but stories about the world. And what I mean by that is I'm talking about cultural pieces. I'm talking about book reviews that are becoming less and less common in newspapers because of the downsizing. I'm talking about the historical perspectives. I'm talking about personal essays that are connect us to larger universal truths about the human condition. That's what the New Republic sees as the void that's being lost here as we provide more and more information online and less stories to our readers.
You know, Chris, I agree with you. I have noticed that we seem to be obsessed with the business of media. Part of it, I think, is due to the extraordinary success of some media outlets, certainly Google. Well, it's called Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, all involved in one way or another in communications. Enormous sums of money. Naturally, that's interesting. And as George was saying, the whole question of survival among newspapers. They're going online. The Dallas Morning News has just announced a plan to go online, has gone online, in fact, as of January, charging, as I recall, about $33 a month if you get the whole package at home and on the web, $17 a month if you go only digital. New York Times just now announced a plan, somewhat more elaborate. You get the first 20 stories free, and then you've got to choose among subscription plans, three of them ranging from $15 a month to $35 a month.
You've looked into this carefully. I
have, oh yes. Depending on whether you want the app on the iPhone or the app on the iPad and so on. So the question is, will these newspapers in smaller cities make money? Will the New York Times make money? You know, it tried putting its columnists online for a fee a couple of years ago, $49 a month, $49.95 for Tom Friedman and Maureen Dowd and the others. Got about 227,000 subscribers, not nearly enough, canceled the service. So the Wall Street Journal, George's old paper, makes money online. The Financial Times makes money online. Why? Because these are very good business papers companies are willing to pay for their people. The question is, will individuals be willing to pay? And we're about to find out.
And I'd like to weigh in on that because it's very interesting to me that some small town newspapers in Texas are only providing online content for pay. In other words, they've created paywalls charging for online content and they're making money. forgive me if I pronounce this incorrectly, but the
Waxahachie
Daily Light is doing just that. They started this a couple of years ago. They weren't at all sure that their readers would continue to pay for content, but they found out pretty quickly that they are, and they're making money online. So they have two different readers, readers that want to get it online, which tends to be the newer, younger readers, and readers that are more than willing to pay for a subscription that will be delivered on their front doorsteps.
And the news is not going, Dallas News is not going to charge for syndicated pieces, the Associated Press and that sort of thing. It will charge for its own reporting, and it certainly has beefed up its own reporting. It's hired new reporters, which is good. Obituaries, the things that the news develops itself will be paid for.
Has the brand of news lost some luster with people? In other words, if they can find their information anywhere, will they just hunt around until they get what they want, as opposed to saying, I want to read this story, I want to read this coverage about what's happening in Austin at the Dallas Morning News?
Oh, I think you're exactly right. In fact, one more comment about the news as a business. It's becoming less and less a business for those who write news. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to become, and I'll be interested in George's view of this, I hope it's different from mine, that it's going to become more and more difficult to make a living writing news because everybody's doing it. But I think you're right. I'm also hearing lately that there are organizations that are establishing concierges for information. So much is coming in that there is now interest in the person, the concierge, editor, you and I would call it, and so would George, who disseminates, who sifts through the information coming in. We're now calling it information. We're now calling it content. We've lost news, and trying to put together something that might be digestible for people. But tell me what you think, George. I hope your view is different from mine, and your students at University of North Texas can make a living in journalism.
I certainly think they can. I mean, it's amazing to me the freelance opportunities that have actually opened up for young writers, both those in school and just out of school, because more and more newspapers and magazines do not have the full-time staffs that they once had. So, yes, I have a number of my students, professors at other universities I know have writers that are young students that are writing for very fine magazines and newspapers across the country. So actually an opportunity has opened up there for young people. But I also want to say, take the Dallas Morning News, which has made a pretty bold and radical decision to become a premium content newspaper.
Closely watched throughout the industry right now.
Exactly. It's bold and radical because no one else has done it. What they're providing is content that they believe their readers can't get anywhere else. And most of the content that we're talking about here are extraordinary photographs, but more importantly, long-form storytelling, the narratives. And what's fascinating is they've done this just at a time when a new technology has come along called the iPad. And that is providing the sort of that technology provides sort of a laid-back consumption experience where you can leisurely read and digest in a very pleasing way content. And it's quite interesting. They've done some studies, and those studies all show that the interest among iPad readers is for long-form stories much more than it is for content for quick information. Mm-hmm. They can get that online. They can't get the long-form stories online, and that's why the Dallas Morning News sees the iPad as a way out of this some of the difficult shoals that we're talking about.
My guests this hour are George Getchow, who is writer-in-residence for UNT's Mayborn Literary Nonfiction Conference and also Instructional Assistant Professor of Journalism at University of North Texas. Lee Cullum is with us as well. She is a journalist and political analyst, serving as moderator this Saturday, March 26th, at the Dallas Institute's Festival of Ideas. We'll resume our conversation about the future of journalism and media in a few minutes. You can join us on the phones at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are journalists Lee Cullum and George Getcho. Both will be participating in the Dallas Institute's Festival of Ideas, which takes place this Saturday, March 26th. You can find information about that on the THINK page of KERA.org or at dallasinstitute.org. If you'd like to be part of our conversation this afternoon about the future of journalism and media, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. As we talk about all these new technologies and how they relate to what we've known from decades ago, it occurs to me that the lines are blurring more and more. You go to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram or the Dallas Morning News, the New York Times, there are video pieces, there are print pieces, things that look traditionally like print, and there really isn't such a difference. Television stations have much longer written pieces available and still photographs. And I wonder if at some point it will cease to matter whether you originated as a hard copy format or something in broadcast or something online.
Oh, I think you're right. I mean, the Huffington Post, for example, as well as This Week, which I referred to earlier, are in many ways composites of other people's work, not generated by themselves. I'd like to go back to something George was saying earlier about the iPad. Mm-hmm. I interviewed Jim Maroney, who's publisher of the Dallas Morning News on CEO, not so long ago. I have great admiration for him. And he was talking about trying to come to terms with Kindle. To have the Dallas Morning News on Kindle, couldn't ever make a deal because of control of the data on their subscribers. The news felt they were the news's subscribers, and therefore whatever information they had about those subscribers belonged to the Dallas Morning News. The Kindle people, which is to say Jeff Bezos at Amazon, insisted on controlling that data. So what could be our undoing, it seems to me, as well as our salvation, naturally, is wrestling over the data. That all that really matters is the data on the subscribers, on the data on the consumers, which are craved by advertisers. And we've always relied on advertising, but I hope that advertisers aren't allowed to overtake these new media in a way that would be unfortunate.
Well, and it's pretty much impossible to stay anonymous if you are doing something online that requires you to pay, where, you know, anybody could walk up to a newsstand and pay with cash and no one knows. You have to give personal information if you want to pay for content online. And I suppose people have become so accustomed to this that they have stopped worrying about it. But at some point, there may be a, do you think subscribers and readers could push back against this?
I think they're in the early stages of online content. I think newspapers were very concerned about that very issue. I think it's becoming less and less of an issue. I do think, though, that for readers to pay for online content, they have to be able to find content that they can't get elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so I think while we talk about providing paywalls and ways to provide revenue streams for newspapers and magazines online, I think one of the things we don't talk enough about is the need to provide quality content. If you're going to – because readers can find content anywhere. And so what do newspapers, what do magazines do to get – to lure readers to their online sites? We're back to the same issue. And I think one of the things that's valuable that the old media can learn from the new media is they have to – I think we have to reject some of the rigid and bland ideas that we've been anchored to for many years. And I think the old media has to be more hip. I think they have to be more relevant. I think they have to start appealing to younger readers because those are the ones that are going to be our – newspaper subscribers and our magazine subscribers of the future. And I think that's why the iPad really is going to be revolutionary in terms of reaching out to that audience that is using these kind of devices to look for stories that matter, to look for information that matter. And as I say, the studies are promising with the iPad. I think that there is ample evidence, growing evidence, that this notion that young people don't read is ridiculous. They do read, and they read in many ways more than the older generation did. They just read it in a different way, and they read it online, and this whole notion of getting them addicted to an iPad way of reading the newspaper or reading a magazine, I think is going to revolutionize the way news and information and stories are delivered.
You mentioned, George, letting go of the rigid way that things have been done. That takes us into this subject of process journalism, what's called process journalism, whereby instead of waiting till a story is entirely complete, little bits of information are put out little by little. And on the one hand, that's very exciting. On the other hand, it's really easy to miss the tweet of a correction made for something that wasn't fully reported. And I wonder what both of you feel about letting things go out little by little and then finally putting it all together in a finished piece.
Well, I agree with you. I think that dribbling things out does make sometimes for misinformation. I think of the upheaval in the Middle East that's been going on since January. The New York Times' coverage has been absolutely superb. I mean, because of the stories that have given historical context, political context, as well as what is going on in day-to-day action. So the gathering of that information and presenting it all at once, I found enormously valuable. And I do want to say this, George. I hope you're right. I'm sure you are, that young people are reading more. I just got back from a weekend conference populated heavily by young people involved in the tech industry, exceedingly bright. Did Libya come up? No. Did the Middle East come up? No. Did Afghanistan? I brought up Afghanistan. Then one asked, yes, and how many troops do we have there? Well, it happens to be 100,000. Japan did come up because there was a young woman from Beijing there working on nuclear power. Yes, I think they are informing themselves about the high-tech world, not necessarily about other things. There's a lack of interest in other things that are riveting to perhaps the three of us. So I'm sure that this was a rarefied group, highly focused on high tech and that world and what it's doing. And it's doing extraordinary things I knew nothing about. But it's still going to take some doing to engage even a highly educated population about affairs in the world.
I'd like to address your question another way, Chris, the question you asked about, do we have to be concerned about information being dribbled out in pieces without having the full context, the full sort of a comprehensive understanding of what's going on? I think that's a problem both in the old media and the new media. In the old media, you are exactly right, doing breaking stories. We are throwing information out on the website, breaking news, before sometimes we have the full story, and the media is rife with all kinds of corrections and amplifications and so on as a result of that. In the new media, I think one of the problems is that facts matter less than creating sort of this audience. Mm-hmm. That seems to propel much of what's being done. It's about corralling an audience that will hear the voices of different people talking about an issue. And sometimes those voices are totally misguided to the point where they create a mob mentality based solely on sentiment and emotion and not on any facts whatsoever. So I think you have some serious problems both in the old media and the new media with respect to the question you raised.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak to Truman in Dallas. Hi, Truman.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Great. Thanks.
I'd like to co-sign what you just now said about information not being less important than the emotion of the story, and I've seen that a lot lately. My question or comment you kind of touched on as far as advertising, I'm in the process of starting a media site for pop culture. It's real niche, you know, for a younger audience. And I was thinking about how much does advertising affect in that situation where everything online was generally free or whatnot, so you don't really have a revenue there except through advertising? How much does that really affect the reporting of the new media as far as you can't run that because it's advertising that or, you know, those types of situations?
So you're asking, is there less in new media of a firewall between advertising and editorial?
Right.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Lee?
Probably so, because I could be wrong, and I'd be interested in George's view. There seems to be a certain amount of chaos in new media, which I think is probably welcome and probably very attractive to a young audience. And of course, if you have chaos, then you're not quite as aware of who the advertisers are, and maybe the advertisers aren't as aware as of what the content is, and that might be all to the good for those who create content.
What do you think, George?
That's a tough question. As President Obama would say, that's kind of above my pay grade. I don't know what it takes in the new media to attract advertisers. I do know this, that many online media companies have more or less found that attracting online advertising is difficult. They've found that what they've found is that advertising does not come to the new media in droves just because you're throwing out content. It has to be the kind of content that is going to be selective, targeted to a specific audience. And that's going to be a big problem with the kind of idea that you were presenting a little earlier.
You know, Truman, also brought up the fact that he's starting a pop culture site. And that, I think, goes back to your point, Lee, where you said you met these young IT professionals who were reading all about their field. I wonder if younger people are, as George says, reading as much as ever, but they have there's so much competition for the time they spend reading what they consider to be new information. Now, we think of hard news as one thing, and it may be that an entire generation really wants to know what's going on with, if I name a rock group, I'm going to get it wrong, but Lady Gaga or something. They know it's not hard news, but that's what they feel like they care about. That's what their friends are all talking about. And that's what is sort of provides them with social capital for a conversation.
Oh, I think that's true. I suppose it's always been that way. I guess People magazine has always done better for Time Warner than Time or Fortune. Nonetheless, it does concern me that we have a highly educated group that seems to have pop culture as its principal concern, and I'm all for pop culture. I think that's great.
George is just shaking his head. All right, let's go back to the phones now. Actually, we'll go here to an email from Bradley, who writes, "There are all these apps for iPhone and iPad. How wonderful. What about those who do not have an iPhone or an iPad?" It's true that there is still a relatively small segment of the population that has access to this technology.
Yeah, it's very expensive. Mm-hmm. $400 for an iPhone and an iPad as well.
Well, most newspapers and magazines actually haven't reached the level of sophistication that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Dallas Morning News have. You can still get plenty of online content without having an iPad. You can also get it on your smartphone, of course, and then you can get it the traditional way delivered at the end of your driveway. So,
or on a laptop.
Exactly. And I think these delivery systems are going to continue to change. I think we're just at the beginning of it.
Perhaps in service to this multimedia world that we now exist in, a lot of journalists working today are expected to not only report the story and write it up, but maybe snap some pictures, capture some video on a cheap camera and throw it up online. And on the one hand, it's great to have this great experience. I wonder, though, the extent to which that gets in the way of doing a really good job at any one of those things.
I think it very well might. It's you, after all, you have to take the time to snap the pictures and do all the rest. So that's time you don't spend making the pivotal phone call, searching out the source. That also takes time, and that's what gets lost.
That's an excellent question. The kind of question we journalism professors are continually asking ourselves, how do we prepare our students for new age journalism? You know, where you've got the video camera on one shoulder, you've got the audio recorder in your hand, you've got a notebook maybe somewhere in your back pocket. You're somewhere, you may be carrying a camera on top of all of this. You're starting to become a pack mule. And how do you provide quality when you have these multitasks to perform on the job? Some newspapers, especially smaller newspapers and magazines, are requiring journalists to be able to do it all. It's a question of resources. Still, the major magazines, the major newspapers, including the Dallas Morning News, most of those folks who are reporters. They have photographers who are photographers. They have videographers who are videographers. So it hasn't gone quite as far as people think. in most metro newspapers, although there are some papers like the Oklahoman where reporters are expected to be online savvy in every way, and that means being able to get the story, get it now, and get it quickly. So again, it's a question of the changing role of journalists. And what do we do from our end in the academic world to prepare students for this ever-changing, ever-evolving world? It's a difficult challenge, but I think one that we are paying attention to and one that I think will sort itself out as we continue to move ahead in this in the treacherous waters of the new media.
Who is vetting and editing all those instantaneous online posts, the ones that are not the official article that goes down, you know, as a record of what the newspaper or the magazine published, but the things that, that come out six times a day in between?
Well, there are online editors, certainly, that are the same editors that are doing editing for the print content. They're also editing the online content. But clearly, the pressure on these editors to get news out quickly and to get it out before anybody else gets it out creates tremendous pressures and demands on these editors. And that's where you come back to the issue that you were referring to earlier, Chris, which is the problems of accuracy, the old values of accuracy, truth, telling, making sure that we get the story right, not just first. And that's where we have some we're sort of in very murky waters, I think.
And, of course, it's been a visual age for quite some time, but never more than now. I heard a guy from Al Jazeera say just yesterday that Al Jazeera was providing the most important coverage of all from Libya, which was a photograph of the rebels or a photograph of the firepower. And, of course, it's very powerful, but it would also help to have some narrative.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Brett on the line. Brett, we'll take your question now, and then after the break, we will get an answer for you. Go right ahead, please.
Okay, great. I was just curious about your opinion on the politicalization of news medias now. There's this conservative and liberal thing going on out there, and I've always believed that good news is factual and has nothing to do with being conservative and liberal. And, I mean, that's why I like KR or any NPR shows. It's factual. It's not liberal. And I would really love to hear your comments on that.
We will get those comments for you in just a minute. Thanks so much for your call, Brett. My guests this hour are George Getchow, who is writer in residence at UNT's Mayborn Literary Nonfiction Conference and teaches journalism at the University of North Texas. Lee Cullum is here as well. She's a journalist and political analyst who will moderate the Dallas Institute's Festival Ideas this coming Saturday, March 26th. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join this afternoon's discussion about the future of journalism and the media, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs, camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are journalists George Getchow and Lee Cullum, both of whom will participate in the Dallas Institute's Festival of Ideas, Saturday, March 26th. There will also be discussions of the future of power and the future of religion and the future of healthcare in that symposium. If you would like more information, you can find it on the Think page of KERA.org, or you can go to dallasinstitute.org. To join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. And that is where, before the break, we had the question about politicization of news. And I wonder if you both would like to speak to that.
Well, that's been a hot-button subject for quite a while. The issue of politics melting into the news side of the newspaper, the magazine, the broadcast program, whatever, is an age-old problem. As journalists, we're trained to be as objective as we can, as truthful as we can, as fair as we can. That doesn't mean that we don't have our own biases. It doesn't mean that we don't bring to stories our own backdrop. Sometimes we're conscious of that backdrop, sometimes we're not. But clearly our what we value as journalists and what we have to teach in on my side of the aisle, which is teach journalism what's important. What do we value? Well, we value truth. We value telling a story for the story's sake to get it right. And the moment that a journalist starts crossing that line into the presenting their own political views, you get away from what we're all about. You get away from the authorial voice of the journalist. And by that, I'm talking about the voice that readers can rely on, readers can depend on, readers can turn to and say, hey, I just got a story here. I didn't get any bias. So it's a difficult area that you're right. The issue of politics creeping into the news side is an ongoing issue. We talk about it a lot. How do we avoid it? I think we avoid it by clinging to those values that we learned in journalism school, we learned on the job, and those are tell the truth, tell it right, tell it objectively.
It does seem, though, George, in this climate, and maybe you want to respond to this too, journalists are presumed guilty until proven innocent of bias, which is a switch from even when I started my career, and that was only 20 years ago.
Oh, I think that's true. And certainly when you have media outlets on television especially that are specializing in a political point of view and making no bones about it, that's going to encourage that kind of thing. But I think that George is absolutely right. The journalism as understood in the journalism schools does imply that you gather facts from all sources and present those facts. I remember hearing Robert Deckard, who runs Belo, which owns the Dallas Morning News, say once that he wanted his reporters to cover other people in the same way that they themselves would want to be covered in the same circumstances. Okay, Joe Smith has been indicted. You write, Joe Smith has been indicted. You don't say it's obvious Joe Smith is guilty. I've always known it. In other words, you can't avoid that he's been indicted.
Right.
You have to mention that. It's on the record. But you don't rush to judgment in your story because what your own views might be. Same thing obtains in political coverage.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Fort Worth now and speak with George. Hello, George.
Hello there. How are you today?
Great, thanks.
Just a comment and then a quick question. I spent 30 years as a journalist from the mid-60s up to about 95. And I think that your guest particularly the professor, should be aware that back in the early 20th century, politicized news was something that went on all the time. If you went to Chicago, for example, you'd have 30 publications, since the print was the only real one you had there. Each one had a different political point of view, and since then there's been a change that came up and kind of peaked in the 60s to move to a different sort of ethical standard of performance. But what's happened today with the Internet, YouTube, and all the rest of this stuff is that there's been a complete degradation of what comes out. And on top of that is the matter of consolidation. And no matter how much someone may respect somebody or another who heads up a corporation that controls broadcast properties, print properties, or radio properties, in different markets, they have one particular problem they have to deal with, and that's a profit. And it affects and distorts and destroys a lot of what the professor's been talking about. My question is this. Moving into the future, I don't see any more a place for the neutral reporter. What I see is a return to the days of early science fiction when they were talking about buttonhole cameras and somebody live all the time covering an event, which goes back to your progressive comment a little earlier, which means you get a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but you don't get the complete story. So I'd like to hear if they think that that's something that may be headed down the road or they see a better future than I do. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, George. Sorry to have that sad dystopia in my head right now, but what do you think? Is it possible?
Oh, there, yes, of course, what he describes is going to happen. And incidentally, I mean, try going back to the late 18th century when Jefferson was promoting a paper that was denigrating Washington every day of the week while Jefferson was serving as his Secretary of State. So he's absolutely right. It's replete in American history. But yes, we're going to have a free-for-all in media without question. I think there will always be a group of people, a cadre, a saving remnant, if you will, that will want objective news that people can rely on. As George says, you know, you read a story, you're going to make a decision about it. Shall I travel to Egypt this month or not? Well, that decision depends on what you're reading about what's going on in Egypt. Is it quiet at Tahrir Square? Is the military going to keep things under control? What's going to happen with elections in June and in August? Can I be there then? If I don't have an accurate story, someone who cares about what the facts really are, then the story is useless to me. So I think there will always be people who care about factual reporting, but there will always be millions who want something else.
Yeah, I think the disconsolate voice that we heard on the other end of the microphone here is really speaking to a growing problem. And the problem is that the wall between citizen journalists and bloggers and traditional journalists, that wall doesn't exist in the political arena. What is news, what is politics gets all meshed up into a giant blog. I call it a blob, because what happens is there is no it's unclear to the readers of these blogs whether this is what are the political biases, what's the bent, what is news, what is commentary, what is analysis. Newspapers and magazines traditionally have tried to make clear when they are providing analysis, when they are providing news content, when they are providing straight reporting. Unfortunately, those distinctions have been lost in the blogosphere, and I think the reader is the listener is absolutely correct in seeing this trend continue. I think that it is dangerous because, again, it can lead to a mob reaction. Mobs react to misinformation, and they react sometimes violently, and they react sometimes unconsciously even. So if they're unconscious about the political bent of the information provider, that can lead to great distortions in understanding and actions that people otherwise wouldn't take.
Do you think the phenomenon of the celebrity journalist is also responsible for this loss of objectivity?
Oh, of course. And what I think is not well understood is often these celebrity journalists couldn't care less about the politics of the matter.
They want to be famous.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And what to do that? They've got to be outrageous. They've got to choose an issue. They've got to be appalled about it, no matter how they really feel. So, yes, it has distorted journalism without question.
George, what's it like to deal with students who don't remember a time before this was the climate?
That's a great question. I think as journalism professors, our job is to teach them the values that we hold dear. And what are those values? They're values of truth-telling, of accuracy, of honesty, of objectivity, of getting the story right. We turn to the great journalists before us and we teach them. These are, in many ways, the wise men and women that preceded us, the Walter Cronkites of the world. We could go on and on with the names, but we use them as sort of benchmarks to say, this is how they did it. This is how we have to continue to value the product that we produce, which is news and information and story. If we lose sight of that, if we lose sight of the values that make journalists people that the public can trust, people that the public can turn to make decisions about what they're going to do or what they're not going to do, if we lose that, we've lost everything.
So to stand up for this, do we have to be willing to pay for it? Do we have to sort of jump over that paywall and say, yes, I'm willing to pay money for this content that
yes,
I can trust?
Yes, you do, mm-hmm. Without question.
Yeah, I think, again, Chris, it's a great question because unless we provide the kind of news, information, and most importantly, stories that make us think, stories that make us feel, stories that are going to change the way we view the world. If we don't provide those stories, then we are nothing more than a part of the blogosphere. We are nothing more than a loud voice shouting among many voices, competing among many voices and not providing what's vital, important, and life-changing to readers.
Let's talk a little bit more as we wrap up about what's going to happen on Saturday. Talk for a minute, Lee, about how the day will be structured.
Well, at 10 o'clock, we'll convene in Horchow Auditorium at the Dallas Museum of Art, and we'll hear from Ken Oletta, who writes frequently about communications for The New Yorker, the finest writer on media in the country, from Mark Oppenheimer, who writes a religion column for The New York Times, very knowledgeable about religion, and in an interesting way. He's written about the history of American religion in the 1960s, about bar and bat mitzvahs across the country, about his years as a debater in high school. And we'll also hear from Steve Krasner, a political scientist at Stanford University, known as a realist of international affairs, who is reworking his remarks every single hour because of the scene keeps changing. We'll also hear from a couple of doctors who are marvelous. Ruth Faden, who is with Johns Hopkins University, runs the Berman Center on Bioethics, and her husband Tom Beecham, who's a philosopher at Georgetown University, who also works on bioethics, and they've written together about informed consent and other really critical issues in medical care. So we'll hear from all of them. We'll hear from people in Dallas, Jim Holyfield and C.M. Brown of the Tower Center at SMU. George Getchow will be there from the University of North Texas, and others, Lynn Kirk, a doctor from Southwestern Medical School, Christine Allison from D Magazine, Bob Mong, editor of the Dallas Morning News, and others. Also, Zia Ulhaq Sheikh, who's the imam of the Islam Center in Irving. So it'll be a good day. It'll be full of many voices and points of view that we hope will also point the way to an enlightened future.
Does it reassure you both that there are people who are willing to pay good money to spend their Saturday engaged in this manner?
I think people are hungry for this kind of thing, Chris, and not offered the opportunity as often as they would like.
Yeah, I think Larry Ellum has done a brilliant job of putting together this festival in all these different areas. In my area, journalism, what I love about the way this is set up is we are going to basically really focus our attention on what is the future of journalism. And it seems to me the kind of questions that are being raised in this discussion here and now are the kinds of things that I think are really important. How is the media landscape going to shake out? Who's going to survive? Who isn't going to survive? When you bring in writers like Ken Oletta, who's written almost a dozen books on this subject, he's a guru. He's somebody who I think has paid a great deal of attention to the future of the media. I think we're going to come away from this forum with a much clearer picture on what lies ahead and what can we do? What role can we play in shaping the future? What role can we play in the journalism side of things, in the academic side of things, in making sure our students are prepared for this risky and yet exciting future. The thing about this is that I'm really excited about the future of journalism, because I think more and more in a complex world, in a dangerous world, people have to have stories that are going to help them make decisions that are to make sure that they are making the kind of decisions that they will be able to survive, prosper. Their kids will be able to survive and prosper. Their community will be able to survive and prosper despite the dangers, despite the concerns.
George Getchow teaches journalism at the University of North Texas, where he is writer in residence for the Mayborn Literary Nonfiction Conference. Lee Collum is a journalist and political analyst who hosts CEO on KERA Channel 13 television. She will serve as moderator of the Dallas Institute's Festival of Ideas on Saturday, March 26th. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.